Before I start, let me just say a couple of things about when I was first discussing with Miqdad what I'd do. And what we agreed was that I'd give a series of talks about the nature of the Shi'i intellectual tradition, looking at it historically and looking at themes, but also looking at the different types of disciplines which make up that tradition. And I'd pitch it at what is sometimes called the intelligent believer. So not as simplistic, perhaps, as my first year introduction to Islam lectures, but not necessarily the sorts of things that I would discuss with PhD students of mine. And also with an eye to the notion that there are various things which I can assume that you know, that you do not need to be told. But at the same time, there is a clear a sense that the vast majority of our communities tend to be quite oblivious of the actual historicity of the tradition. You will very rarely actually hear most of the names who I'll be discussing over these four sessions. And that's one of the reasons actually why I've given you handouts. For those of you who do know the tradition, these will not be new names. But for those of you whose acquaintance is restricted to the majlis and the odd weekend madrasa session, I'm pretty sure these names will be very new to you. So it's really about the need to engage with what the tradition is and to engage with it a bit more deeply, because if we actually want to understand where we are and who we are today, then you need to have a basic historical consciousness of how we got here. It's a basic assumption I have in the work I do, and it's a basic assumption I think that a lot of people in philosophy and theology tend to do as well. Because if you forget the history of how you got here, then to a certain extent some of the ideas, some of the references that you will then come across in contemporary works are quite meaningless, because they're not rooted in a context. They're not rooted in a particular story of how you've arrived there. So that's the reason for doing it in that way. Last time I looked at the formation of the tradition insofar as I was looking at the development of early Shi'i literature, and I discussed particularly some of the genres that were around then. Today I'm going to look at theology, next time will be philosophy, and then the final session will, broadly speaking, be on mysticism. But let me say a few things about theology and what theology might mean. And what I'm going to do today is I'll start by some thoughts about what theology means in an Islamic context. And then I'll quickly trace some of the history of systematic theology in the Shi'i tradition, and then I'll end in the final section with some of the key arguments and some of the key issues which arise in the theological traditions as they are, and we'll look at some text as well as part of that. So to begin, one of the basic challenges we face, and this is a challenge especially in the academic study of religions, is that a lot of religious traditions and religions don't necessarily have entirely the same types of phenomena. Or rather, the language we have, which we use to talk about religion, is primarily derived from the study of Christianity and the history of Christianity, and particularly the history of Protestant churches. And it's not always the case that some of that language is easily transferable to other traditions. So even if we take the concept of theology, which is very well established in the study of Protestant churches, the first question which arises if we want to consider what we mean by theology in Islam is, what are we looking for? Are there particular genres or disciplines of writing that we can look at? How do we even render this term theology into a term which is, for example, used in the seminary. And this basically raises a fundamental problem. Now, of course, what theology even means in a Christian context is quite broad as well. But let me say, first of all, what I think theology is, and then I will say something about what the particular types of genres of writing that exist in the tradition are, which conform to what we're trying to deal with. At its very basic level, the term theology, of course, means giving an account for God, a basic compound, a Greek compound, which the word comes from. Traditionally, it's primarily about studying the nature of God, arguing why God exists, what sort of properties does God have. For example, is God all-knowing, all-wise? Is he the sole creator? What are the implications of the actions that God has? Does he act in time and so forth? And then, of course, various aspects of how God reveals himself, which are quite important also in the Christian tradition. Now, what I suggest we do when we look at the question of theology is we don't just look at some of these big ontological questions about existence, but rather theology has to start with a study of a basic tripartite relationship, but needs to go beyond that. Now, what's that tripartite relationship? That tripartite relationship is the basic notion that there are three types of realities in existence. And they're not coeval, they're not equal in any sense. But they're three parts of the equation, if we want to understand what theology is at its basic. And these three parts basically are God. The second one is humanity. And the third one is the cosmos. And so at its very basic level, what theology does is it tries to understand what the relationship is between these three. So if we talk about the existence of God, that has implications for how we understand the cosmos around us. That has implications for how we understand ourselves. And then, of course, how we understand our relationship with our cosmos around us. And then, of course, what that implies then back to an understanding of God. And that's a very basic, fundamental, foundational level of what we understand by theology. But above and beyond that, as I said, this is what you might call high theology. Theology is also very much concerned with what it means to be human. So there are a number of questions which arise with respect to what it means to be human, such as how do we know certain types of things? How can we decide whether a certain act is right or wrong? How something is good or bad? How can we make certain types of predictions about our future? How can we understand our social interactions? And the human level, which is apparent and immediate for us, is a very important part of theology as well. And it's very much sometimes called theological ethics or religious ethics, but it's very much central to a lot of the understanding nowadays that we have for what we mean by theology. So theology cannot just be at the macro level looking at the nature of God or looking at God the creator and what our existence and the existence of the cosmos indicates with respect to his being. But rather it has to also be very much concerned with the human level. You know, what does the fact that one is a person of faith, what does that imply for how one lives and how one interacts in the social sphere? And that's extremely important. And this focus on the individual and the focus of the care of the self, as it's sometimes called, or the concern with the self or the concern with the soul, as being central to what is sometimes called wisdom, is already indicated in a very famous saying attributed to Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, which is defines wisdom as wisdom is, has three parts. There are three elements to wisdom. One is a concern with understanding where we came from. The second is a concern to understand who we are. And the third one is a concern to understand where we're going. The whence, what, and the whither. And this is a fundamental definition of what wisdom is. So the focus or the centrality on the human is also an extremely useful attitude to take when we're considering theology. And we'll come to back to this next week, and not next week, in the next two sessions, quite simply because it links in with elements in the philosophical and certainly in the mystical tradition about how everything starts very much with the self and the soul. Now, if we're interested in these issues, and also, you know, when we're talking about things like how do we know, then we have also questions about how we use language, what the nature of language is, how we understand texts. So, for example, how do we understand and make sense of the Quran? How do we understand and make sense of hadith and so forth, which has a lot to do with language. So if we then want to map this sort of concept of conception of a theology, then there are a number of different types of genres generally in the Islamic traditions and also specifically in the Shi'i one, which map onto these. There's, of course, what's known as ilm al-kalam, which is, broadly speaking, systematic theology. It's systematic rational theology in which a complete account is given, starting with issues about epistemology, how we know things, starting with issues around the nature of language, the nature of signification, the nature of existence, and going through to the existence of God, properties and attributes that God may have, going on to discussions about creation, about the nature of the human, about human moral responsibility, and then going all the way through to issues around guidance, around prophecy, around imamah, and so forth. But it's a systematic, rational approach to providing a complete apologetic or complete defense of what the faith is. And this is an important point about kalam, is that traditionally it was about providing a community with a defense, a justification for why they held certain types of beliefs or what the nature of their faith was. And then there are various other types of works. There are sort of what are known as aqidah works, sometimes creedal. You can use the term creedal or creed in English. These are not terribly common in the Shi'i tradition. There are not very many of them. But they're generally quite common in the Islamic tradition. And they have similar functional roles to creeds in Christianity, insofar as they're about the way in which imperial power then imposes certain types of proper ways of thinking. Another genre which is quite important theologically is, of course, heresiography, the so-called firaq literature. And the function of the firaq literature is about defining the boundaries of the community. And it does that by defining who does not belong. It defines heresy. And it defines what is considered to be incorrect belief. And this, again, is a very important part of theology. And it's actually a genre of theological writing which is found in practically every type of Islamic theological persuasion. It's almost universal. It's one of the few types of theological reasoning which are found in every single group and affiliation within Islam. And these works still continue to be written, although they perhaps are sometimes of a less polemical nature, but that's not necessarily always the case. And the fourth and the final type of genre, which I just want to flag, which renders a theology, is of course what is considered to be the ultimate discipline of the Hawza, basically Usul al-Fiqh. Now, of course, strictly speaking, Usul al-Fiqh is about the foundations of understanding what law is. But a large chunk of Usul is concerned with the nature of language and the nature of how language maps onto the world that we inhabit and how we make sense of that world and then how we make sense of text. So it's also a very important theological form of writing. Now, moving on to some of the historical sketch, I already indicated last time that theological reasoning had already begun in the time of the Imams, and there are a few famous individuals who I had mentioned who were associated with this type of reasoning. And there also are certain works, certain disputations which the Imams are supposed to have taken part in, which also reveal an engagement with theological reasoning. So whether that's the Kitab al-Tawheed or Ahlil Jiyya, which is associated with Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, or whether it is the disputations, the munadharat of Imam Rida alayhi salam, which are recounted in the Uyun Akhbar Rida. So there's various types of sources which already exist, which demonstrate that the Imams were engaged in theological disputation and reasoning in the way in which people around them at that time were dealing with already as well. But a lot of that work is very similar to a lot of early theological writings. Is pretty straightforward. It's not systematic in any sense. It's not as sophisticated as writings which one comes across later. And in the earliest periods of the development of a systematic theology, a development of a systematic kalam, an imami kalam, what you find is the influence of the Mu'tazila starting. So if you take the earliest figures, the Nawbakhti family in particular, at the end of the 9th century, these are the first individuals who start to write works which fit very much within the Mu'tazili tradition. And then the first really serious systematic thinkers, Sheikh Mufid, who dies in 1022, and Sharif Murtada, who dies in 1044, their works are also fundamentally influenced by two different types of schools of the Mu'tazila. Now, before I go on, I just want to say something about the Mu'tazila and the process of dealing with rational theology. There's a widespread myth, which you may well have come across, which is that the Mu'tazila were free-thinking rationalists who only believed in the authority of reason. This is a fundamentally mistaken conception. There's hardly any actual evidence for this. It's very difficult to see how one could have such a rationalist working within a religious frame of thinking. In fact, if you look at a lot of the Mu'tazili writings from the earliest period, and if you look at the developments of early Shi'i kalam, which of course is also marked by the same types of approaches to rationalism or to rationality, what you actually find is that reason is something which is very much embedded in a wider context. So reason is embedded within a context in which there is a basic assumption about the existence of a God. There is a basic assumption about revelation. And there is a notion that if a person wants to understand who he is, what his or her relationship is with God and the cosmos around him, him or her, then it's not sufficient just to use reason, but reason has to be embedded in a wider set of significations and understandings, which include the use of revelation, which include actual practice, which include inheritances of tradition and so forth. And there are various examples which are given, you know, from the earliest texts, which do say that there are certain things which reason cannot actually determine. One of the classic examples of this is that while a lot of the early imami thinkers from Sheikh Mufid onwards were insistent that the existence and the necessity of an imam in the same way as the existence and necessity of a prophet was rationally defensible and rationally sound, and could be justified by recourse to syllogistic forms of reasoning using Aristotelian logic, one could not find a rationale or an argument for why there should be a certain number of imams, nor what the particular sequence of those imams would be, nor like how long they would live and so forth. You know, all these sorts of basic historical details could not be rationally discerned because they were to a large extent historically accidental. And so these were things that one had to know from other types of authority, which we broadly call revelation. So it's only revelation, it's only scriptural sources which could determine the number and some of those details. But you could use reason to come up with an argument for why the existence of guidance in the form of a person was necessary. Now, the one, I just mentioned two other things with relationship to the Mu'tazila, which are quite important. There are a number of points on which even these earliest figures who were extremely influenced by Mu'tazili thinkers differed with the Mu'tazila. But there are a few themes which they did take on from the Mu'tazila, which is quite important. For example, the Mu'tazila generally were known as the people of divine justice and unity, Ahl al-Adl wa al-Tawheed. And this absolutely firm central insistence on divine justice was very important. Because the basic postulation that God was just then led to all sorts of outcomes. So, for example, if God was just and then he were to place a certain type of burden, a moral burden, an intellectual burden upon people that he had created, then of course he had to allow them the ability to bear that burden. And he had to ultimately provide elements of what are sometimes called facilitating grace, the term is lutf in Arabic, so that they could carry out the burdens that they were imposed with. And this is quite important, that justice entails this. Justice entails that God requires certain things of you, but then God also gives you the facilities so that you can do that. Other issues around it are, for example, when one is enjoined, for example, to do good and told to avoid what is bad or evil, then if one does that, there are consequences for it. There is reward and punishment associated with it. So this whole structure, in a sense, of moral agency is very much underpinned by this notion of divine justice. And this is something which fundamentally was taken up from Mu'tazili thinking. That you had a core which was, the foundation was justice, and the core instrumentalization of this justice was this notion of lutf, or this notion of facilitating grace. And the two fundamental expressions of lutf that, well, there's three fundamental, that God provided is, one is your person and the faculties that you had, and which were in a sense an internal guide, which allowed you to understand things so that you could fulfill what God required of you. And the secondary was an external kind of guide, in the form of revelation, in the form of a person who would guide you, who would then help you also understand. So the internal guide ultimately is the basic capacities that you have as a human, and the most important of those was, of course, a rational capacity, the ability to understand things. And the external guide, the external act of grace, was the nature of revelation, the person of the prophet, and then, of course, the person of the imam in the Shi'i tradition. And this is the relationship between justice and then lutf, and the way in which justice is instrumentalized is absolutely central to the classical medieval Shi'ite theological tradition. And it remains a very important issue. I mean, the issue of justice remains something that, you know, we encounter from the earliest time, and what the justice of God entails for others. I'll skip some of the differences between with the Mu'tazila. We can discuss that later if you want. The medieval tradition then culminates after Mufid and Murtada, particularly with Allama Hilli, Ibn Mutahhar al-Hilli, who died in 1325, and certainly for those of you who've been in Najaf, you will have seen his grave, which is actually inside the building of the Haram of Imam Ali. And in many ways, he's one of the most important medieval Shi'i thinkers. Extremely important in terms of his influence, in terms of his contributions to thought, in theology, in fiqh, in usul, in many other areas. And one of the important things that he did, he wrote a number of works in theology, but one of the most straightforward and simple is a work which is known as the 11th chapter, Al-Bab al-Hadi Ashar, which remains to a certain extent to this day a basic introductory theological text for the seminary. It's still the case. It's available in a not a terribly good English translation. There is a new English translation which will be out soon. But it gives you a very good idea of the concerns that the medieval tradition had, and it gives you a complete view of how you explained certain types of things, beginning with the need to use reason to understand the world, the requirement for each and every one of us who takes on a moral obligation. You know, each and every one, the idea is each and every one of us decides that we want to be believers, and once we are rational adults, then we have to choose to do so, and we have to understand what that means, that we have a basic requirement, an obligation to know God. And we have a basic obligation to then understand what that knowledge and recognition of God entails for the way in which we live our lives and we understand our reality. And then it goes on from there and deals with the standard five principles of theology, starting with Tawheed, Adl, and divine attributes, going on to Nubuwa, Imama, and Ma'ad, the concept of the afterlife. So this text then becomes a very central text, and we might have a bit of time to have a look at some of the arguments which are there, which to a certain extent, even today, if you gave a Shi'i theologian or someone who teaches this stuff in the Hawza or studied it, this text, they'll say, yeah, they totally recognize it. These are the basic arguments which always are given. And the reason why these arguments are given is because they are an aid, an assistance. Ultimately, no one is allowed to merely follow doctrines. You have to understand what doctrines are and what they mean for you. You're not allowed to follow them blindly. You're not allowed to just take what someone says and accept at face value, especially about the nature of God. And I'll come later to a couple of arguments which are given for why you should not do this. So taqlid, as it's called, in matters of faith is, as the term goes, it's haram. It's as strong as that. And this is fundamentally something which I think, unfortunately, most people do not understand. They fail to understand that there is a certain remit or an area which law and elements of ethics cover, and there is an area which theology covers, and they do not overlap. But I won't get into issues around taqlid in law. That's a wholly different game. And as I said, I'll come to that in a bit. So the central figure in the medieval tradition is Hilli. Now, there are other types of developments in theological reasoning that you then also see. For example, From the 13th, 14th century, you get the influence of the Sufi Ibn Arabi, which comes within the Shi'i circles. You get individuals like Abdulrazak Kashani, you get Sayyid Haider Amuli. And these individuals basically take on some of the key ideas from the mystical theology of Ibn Arabi, and then appropriate it within the Shi'i context. And there's certain ways in which they do that. And this turn is quite important, because what it shows is, as the medieval tradition develops, it becomes at times quite difficult to clearly distinguish and differentiate between what is strictly speaking theological, what is strictly speaking philosophical, and what is strictly speaking mystical. Because increasingly there is a much more holistic approach to the nature of intellectual inquiry. And so then with the next level, which is broadly speaking kalam in the Safavid tradition, in the 16th, 17th century, with the philosophers Mir Damad, Mullah Sadr, and people like that, you get a further development in the sense that theological forms of argument and theological concerns are then subsumed under philosophy, and this is something we'll discuss next time. I'll just indicate one thing as we go along, which is that even within theology, arguably there are two primary, and this again comes from the study of Christianities, there are two primary modes in which one might do theology. There is what's known as a positive mode of doing theology, and there's one which is called a negative mode of doing theology. There's what's known as kataphasis and apophasis in Greek. Kataphasis is basically when one makes positive assertions and arguments about what God is, and then tries to explain what God is in the sort of terms that we use as humans. So we say things like God is merciful, and God is a creator, and God is knowing. We're making positive assertions about the nature of God. This is positive theology. This is kataphasis. Apophasis is the notion that you can only use the negative to understand what God is, because ultimately God is utterly transcendent and utterly unknowable. There is a sense in which we can try and understand what God is, but that attempt at understanding will always be frustrated. It will always be unachieved eventually. And there's two ways in which this happens. One is by making what one might call negative assertions about the nature of God. So you say, God is not so and so. Or by placing God entirely out of the system of the reality that we inhabit directly, and to say that there is no analogy between the language we use for ourselves and the cosmos that we inhabit and the language that we use for God. And in the Safavid tradition, this becomes a debate about the nature of the words that we use. So, for example, if we use the term merciful to describe God, does it mean exactly the same thing that we mean when we, for example, describe an individual as being merciful, like a person, a human, as being merciful? Is there an overlap in its meaning? Or is it merely that we're using the same term for some sort of conventional and convenience that we have, but we are insistent that the term, while being the same term, means something totally different, and that there is no connection between the meaning? Now, in the Safavid period, this was known as an issue of the nature of the ishtirak al-ism, right? What is the commonality of the word? Is it purely the nature of the utterance, the formal nature of the word? It's merciful, merciful. Or is there some, and this is called lafzi, or was it ma'nawi? Was there something about the meaning of this term which was shared? Now, the vast majority of the theological tradition insisted that there had to be an overlap in meaning, or else this would not function as language because it would not communicate. So even when God describes himself, for example, in the Quran, as being merciful, there would have to be a shared element of that understanding which we would understand when, for example, we say, so-and-so is merciful. Because if it was not the case, that then it would be unsuccessful communication. And ultimately, God doesn't engage in unsuccessful communication. There's a basic assumption, again, comes back to issues of justice. If God is just, then of course anything he says has to make sense. And God doesn't lie and God doesn't mislead and so forth. The other camp who insisted that the term itself was shared argued that because God is utterly transcendent and utterly unknowable, there cannot be any meaningful overlap between what we intend by merciful in these two cases. God is merciful, or Ali is merciful, or Muhammad is merciful, whatever. They have to be utterly different. And so this tension between positive and negative theology is already there, and it comes out in the Safavid period. It comes up in other times as well. The whole issue of negative theology is far more interesting, but I should probably move on before I totally kill you. Now, before we come to some arguments which are really going to thrill and excite you, theology has changed. And certainly in the last 30 or 40 years in particular, there's been a development even within the seminary and certainly outside of the seminary of what's known as the new theology, Kalam-e Jadid, as it's called in Persian in particular. And the basic question is, of course, well, why do they need a new theology? They need a new theology because fundamentally most people are not concerned about the intricacies of what it means when you say God is knowing. And does that mean he knows through an attribute of knowing, or does he have a certain state of knowing, or is it the fact that he knows through his essence? Most people, frankly, do not argue about such things. And so there was a sense in which there was a need to reorient theology to deal with fundamental issues which were of concern to people. And it had to be about bringing theology to the human level, and to focus it at that human level, where people were interested, where people were arguing. And so then it became a question of dealing with issues such as, well, what do we mean by faith? What is the nature of faith? What is the nature of religious experience? How do we know that? How do we know certain types of things? It was about gearing theology towards a much more explicit social and political consciousness, towards what is sometimes also called a liberation theology. That theology had to engage with issues of oppression, had to engage with issues of inequality within society. And the very term liberation theology in its origins also comes from a Catholic, particularly South American context, in which you had Catholic theologians trying to use their faith and theological training to argue about how they could help people understand the predicaments they were in. And the main way they did this was basically by adopting Marxist thought. And certainly a number of the early new theologians in the 60s, in particular 50s, 60s, were heavily influenced by Marxist thought, by leftist thought of various types. With the new theologians, of course, you had people who were working very much within the seminary, and you had people like Murtaza Mutahhari. And then, of course, you had a number of other people who were much more non-clerical individuals, reformers, starting, I guess you could even consider Ali Shariati in that case, although I wouldn't consider him a theologian, but we can argue about that later. But certainly, more recently, people like Abdul Karim Suroosh, Mohsin Kadivar, Atala Mahajarani and so forth. And so new theology is very much, as I said, about reorienting things towards the human level, dealing with issues around social interaction, dealing with issues of gender, of sexuality, which are absolutely immediate to our existence, dealing with issues around things like how do you deal with religious diversity? There's no doubting that religious diversity is a basic fact of the world in which we live. So how do we deal with it? How do we come to terms with it? What sort of theoretical positions can we take with respect to arguments around the nature of pluralism, for example? And how do we then make sense of the world in which we live? Before I come to some of these themes and arguments, which I mentioned I would come to at the end, let me just say one thing, that one of the reasons why it was felt that there needed to be a paradigm shift, so to speak, or a change in what theology meant in the contemporary, and this is true of many religious traditions, it's not just true of Islam or Shi'i Islam in particular, was because fundamentally the notion of religion or what theology was had changed in the post-Enlightenment modern world. Religion was increasingly seen as a private matter. It was seen, faith was something which you held in within. Faith was not something which was enacted, but faith was about beliefs that you had. And beliefs are then defined by doctrines and positions that you hold and you justify. But they're ultimately meaningful for you and you only. This, of course, is very different from the way in which religion was seen, certainly in a pre-modern period. It was not just about matters of holding certain types of beliefs or propositional truths that you could formulate within the self. And it's also predicated on the idea that the fundamental unit or the fundamental approach in understanding religion or faith or anything like that in the modern world, it's about the individual, and the individual makes certain types of choices, including rational choices, purely for him or herself, without any recourse to anything else. And these processes of rationalization are entirely internal. The notion that we have some sort of autonomy and freedom to make those sorts of choices, and we make them entirely uninhibited and unencumbered by the context in which we find ourselves and various other types of influences. This is, of course, is a fundamental myth of the modern world. No one actually lives like that. We're not sort of disembodied minds which have no connection with each other. And we certainly don't ever make rational choices in some sort of vacuum. It just doesn't work like that. And it fundamentally goes against the basic notion of what it means to be human, because what it means to be human is to have social interaction, is to be embedded within communities, within societies, in which there are multiple types of influences going on at all times. And to assume such a sort of an extreme version of autonomy is fundamentally problematic. This is a hugely debated area in contemporary philosophy, so I will not say any more about that now. Now, coming to some of the arguments, and I think I can probably only mention three. I'll start with where, and this is sort of going back, and the reason why I'm going back to the traditional, the medieval tradition, is because there are certain elements of that tradition which I think are still extremely valuable. And they're valuable especially where they start. And they start on the issue of reason, or reflection, if you want. The term is nadhar in Arabic. Practically every theological text starts with this basic imperative that one has to use one's nadhar to understand and know God, and that this is a moral obligation, which is, as I mentioned before, incumbent upon every individual, and it's absolutely incumbent. There's no way of getting around it. And what this means, of course, is knowing God, knowing his relations, how he interacts with the world, what it means to be human, where we're coming from, who we are, where we're going to. And that one does this in order to, of course, acquire knowledge and understanding or recognition of these facts, and ultimately to try and achieve some sort of certainty in which one is convinced about what these things mean. One of the reasons why one tries to do that, to seek certainty and to be convinced, is because the absence of knowledge or that understanding or certainty within the soul or within the intellect or within yourself is considered to be an absence which is psychologically painful. And it's psychologically painful because ignorance is actually an element of fear. If you're ignorant, you're actually fearful of what might be the case, or of you're not sure where you are, where you're going. And so fear is something which has to be eradicated. The psychological pain of being in a state of ignorance is something which has to be eradicated. Hence the fundamental need to deflect that pain, to deflect that fear of the unknown by using one's reason to move towards knowledge. And within that, there are a number of arguments which are then given for why one should not merely follow someone else's opinion, i.e. why one should not just do taqlid in matters relating to the nature of God, and some of the really major important questions. And there's one particular text which discusses two questions, which are both quite amusing, because it's a lot of theological works take the form of, well, if you say this, or if you make this objection, or if you make this point, then this is my response. It's kind of a dialectical form of argumentation. So in this case, what happens is there's a hypothetical person saying, yes, you must do taqlid, and this is why you do taqlid, and then the theologian's responding. So the first argument, which is a very easy one to deflect, is someone says, you must do taqlid because that's what most people do. And the simple response is, that's not a rational argument. And that is not something which would possibly appeal to you. And it certainly wouldn't deal with the fear and psychological pain within the self, because it's not satisfying. And because we know that it's quite likely that what the vast majority of people do is just wrong on all sorts of counts. So what the majority does not really make any sort of rational case. The second one involves saying, well, you know, what taqlid means is that you basically just follow a particular doctrine without being given proof for it, and without consideration of any other things, because you're basically following someone who has an informed opinion. The response to that is, regardless of where that opinion comes from, the fact that there is no proof given means that it doesn't convince you, and the fact that you're not considering other issues means that you could potentially be in a situation in which you've gathered various types of doctrines through different acts of taqlid, so to speak, which are fundamentally contradictory, which do not hold together. And so all that happens is that your state of confusion or ignorance or psychological pain does not go away. And it is fundamentally irrational for someone to collect a whole bunch of contradictory opinions and hold them. It would not satisfy basic notions of what is rationally sound. This strikes me as being a fairly decent argument for why one shouldn't do taqlid. But again, it's slightly fixed in the sense that you know, what happens if you're then accepting an opinion which is reasoned or is placed within a certain context, which has various types of corroborating opinions which then support it, what are known as qara'in in Arabic. Now, there's an associated issue about why do we need to know God and why do we need to make sense of what that means for us? One of the arguments given for why this is rationally necessary is that it starts something like this by saying, well, we're created or we're contingent beings, which means that we had a beginning, we came into existence at some point, we're created. And if we assume that a something has created us and given us certain types of bounties and possibilities and faculties, you know, like such as life, such as intellect, such as the ability to do things, then these acts of these gifts, so to speak, these bounties that we're given, require some sort of reciprocation. Because we know that it is rationally true that if someone gives you a gift or a bounty, then you respond by being thankful. And so the necessity to know God and to know what that entails is simply acting out the rational necessity to thank someone who has benefited you. And it's very simple. The concept is known as shukr al-mun'im, thanking someone who has benefited you, thanking the benefactor, so to speak. And this is a really fundamental issue of, and it's very interesting because what's happening here is you're being given a rational argument which is very much actually embedded in the social interactions that we have. You know, we're all familiar with the notion of gift giving. We're all familiar with the notion of benefiting each other. And we're all familiar with the notion that you have to reciprocate in some form. Right, whether that's just by, you know, of a word of thanks, or whether that's by doing other types of acts, and it's important that often, coming back to what I said at the beginning, you know, reason is not something which is entirely independent. It's very much embedded in other types of issues. It's embedded in our experiences. It's embedded in acts of revelation. It's embedded in other ways of understanding what it means to be human. Now, I realize I've probably gone way over time. So I will just finish with one further argument. There are a hell of a lot of arguments which are worth considering. But one final thing which is absolutely central, of course, to what it means to be Shi'i, and is central as a way of explaining what I was describing earlier, this relationship between the notion of divine justice and how it's instrumentalized through grace. And this is the argument about why you need an imam. And this argument goes back at least to Sharif Murtada, but you find even a form of it in Sheikh Mufid, and arguably you find versions of it even in some hadith literature, but the way in which is justified in Sharif Murtada is slightly different. Sharif Murtada's argument is that basically divine justice entails that, you know, as I mentioned before, that God gives us acts of grace which help us to fulfill our moral obligations and to fulfill what it is that we owe him in our act of giving thanks to the person who's the individual who has benefited us. And one of the ways in which he does this, of course, is through external guidance. So there is a need then for God to provide this sort of guidance in the form of an external individual, an individual external to you. Now, then, of course, you have the issue of, well, why a particular individual? And why does, for example, that particular individual who is designated as an act of grace, why does that person have to be perfect in all sorts of ways? You know, why does that person have to be the most excellent, the most knowledgeable, and this and that? And that's where a different type of argument comes in, which is, broadly speaking, an argument relating to infinite regress, an argument relating to a hidden assumption that actual infinites do not obtain. So the basic rule in ancient and medieval science is that there's no such thing as an actual infinite. There's a conceptual infinite, but there's no actual infinite. You cannot have an actual chain of entities which goes on ad infinitum in reality. You can conceive of them, but you cannot have them in reality. So the standard one goes that, okay, so say you follow an individual, but that person is not perfect, then that person has to follow someone else, who has to follow someone else, and you have a chain, you know, going back. Because ultimately you want to be following the guidance which has some sort of independent reality, some sort of firmly established reality. And given the rule that actual infinites do not obtain, it would make sense if you just went immediately to the individual who is the best. So the argument for why one needs an imam and why that imam then has to be infallible, has to have perfect knowledge and so forth, is then given a certain type of syllogistic form. And this basic syllogism, which shows or which is supposed to demonstrate why the imam needs to be of certain qualities and that this is something which is rationally necessary, as I said, is established in the 11th century and then fundamentally remains the same argument even to this day. And it remains one of the central theological arguments there is within the Shi'a tradition. And there's all sorts of ways that you can kind of modify it and play around it. But it still remains an important one precisely because of the centrality of the concept of imamah in the Shi'a tradition entails that you have to find some sort of, if you're going to do rational theology, find some sort of rationale for explaining how that works. And one cannot just take it as a traditionalist might do from text. Because if you were to just take it from text, then the nature of that tradition would be fundamentally different. And I'm sorry for going over, and I will stop at that point, and hopefully there's some questions. Thank you. Genre is a type of writing, like a type of literature, like exegesis or genre. Yeah, it's French, it's English. Jins. In Arabic or Persian, it would be jins. Yeah, type of writing, class of writing.
Assalamu alaikum, Professor. Thank you very much for your lecture, very enlightening, and thanks for making the time and effort to come and explain these themes to us. I've got a general question really about whether there is any arrangement between Muslim scientists and thinkers, philosophers to be available to second generation Muslims and the young people who are usually might get really confused about a lot of these themes, and you eloquently explain things about iman and about faith, and it is not only about reading, but about other factors as well. And because I think there is a lack of arrangement for Muslim young generation. Who get bewildered, and they are usually affected by the secular liberal ideology that's available in the West, and they don't know where to go. They don't know whom to ask. And there's I know that a lot of young people go to Sheikh Bahmanpour and ask him, but not everybody knows Sheikh Bahmanpour, and certainly not everybody knows thinkers and scientists like yourself. I don't know if there is any website or whether a Muslim scientist has made an arrangement for this kind of need.
You raise a very, very good point. Some of these things can actually be done at a very basic level. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the idea of philosophy for children. And we all know, some of you, if your memories are good enough, or certainly those of you who have young children will know that that children do have very interesting questions. There's no reason why you shouldn't actually ask people to think about questions from a very early age. And at least understand this notion that ultimately each and every one of us has a basic responsibility to come up with a rationale for what one is doing and what one is professing. Now, above and beyond that, what you're mentioning is basically how can you then call upon different types of resources which will help you understand that. Now, for me, one of the fundamental functions of theology, which is very much like philosophy, it goes back to this notion of Plato. The philosopher is like the midwife. And the philosopher is like the midwife in the sense that he is acting to facilitate understanding, the birth of understanding, so to speak, right? And that birth of understanding, that sort of ma'rifah, which all the theological texts talk about, is really what you want to get at. But it's something which ultimately you've got to do for yourself. And all that you can do is you can use, of course, your internal and external resources for doing that. And then, of course, you call on people who have an understanding of certain things, who might help you, who might facilitate that process. But it still has to be a process which you undergo yourself. And, you know, you're always going to be faced with, you know, what the philosophers call epistemic peer conflict. You're always going to be faced with this process where different people hold different views and they arrive at those views in different ways. But we basically assume that each of them holds those views for a reason. We basically assume that they're rational agents. So you still have to deal with that issue. But all, as I said, you can do is you can use the internal and external resources you have, and you can try and, you know, call upon people to help you understand what that is. But ultimately, you know, an understanding can never be borrowed. Even the function of a text like Al-Bab al-Hadi Ashar is really about facilitating that understanding. It's not about just saying, okay, this is theology. You read this, you internalize it, you got it. Because there are lots of questions which might arise about how that works. Even if you take something as simple as the classic infinite regress argument relating to whether actual infinites obtain, that's a huge argument in mathematics about whether actual infinites obtain. So, you know, you can't necessarily take things at face value in that sense. But, you know, it's also about trying to inculcate, you know, coming back to this idea of ignorance as a psychological pain. It's about trying to alleviate that to bring some sort of peace or, again, what Plato would have called tranquility in the soul. Then that's absolutely fundamental. You won't necessarily do that purely from rational theology anyway. That's where the next two sessions might come in as well. There has to be more to it. But the fundamental requirement of all of us that we have to use our nadhar to gain the ma'rifah of God is something you cannot escape, because that's something that every rational adult has to do. You're right, reading books is not necessarily sufficient, but there are not very many people around who might even help that understanding. And also different people need different things. Not everyone needs the same thing. Not everyone can actually even call upon the same sort of individual, because they won't be helpful. But I probably haven't answered your question.
Thank you very much for your talk. In terms of the Mu'tazila sort of the Shi'i versus Sunni development here, so there were quite a lot of Sunni Mu'tazila in the early stages before the Mihna and stuff, and then how did that affect the Shi'i Mu'tazili belief, if you like? I mean, did it push it a lot? Was there a lot? So that's the first part of the question. Yeah. The second part is more on the justice side of things, given it's so central to the Mu'tazili belief or the theological structure, how is justice defined from a rational, closed rational perspective? I mean, I don't understand how you can define what justice is in that respect. Thank you.
Okay, the first part is easier than the second one. In terms of the first part, simple. They fundamentally from the beginning disagreed on those points. So they had no agreement on imama, whether it was necessary or not, or you know, who. That was a disagreement from the beginning. They disagreed on what the nature of faith was. From the earliest period, the sort of the Shi'i thinkers insisted that it had to be both tasdiq, assent, but it also had to be something which was verbal articulation. They disagreed, for example, on issues around intercession. The Mu'tazila on the whole were not terribly in favor of intercession. They disagreed on what the nature of the threat, the so-called divine threat, that basically if you're bad, you go to hell, and if you're good, you go to heaven. They were not convinced that it was entirely as straightforward as that, and that's where Shafa'a sort of comes in, intercession comes in. So there are a whole range of issues on which they disagreed right from the beginning. Of course, within a Sunni context, I guess you could argue precisely because of the establishment of Sunni Islam primarily as an imperial faith in which a certain type of doctrine was acceptable and anything else didn't work, the Mu'tazila didn't really survive. But they survived in other areas, particularly amongst the Zaydis and the Imamis, quite simply because of things like the notion of justice and lutf. Using justice and lutf was extremely useful if you wanted to make sense of why you needed external guidance in the form of an individual, and why and how, for example, you used your reason. Now, I hope that kind of works for the first part. For the second part, absolutely, it's a really problematic issue of what you understand by justice. Because ultimately, we often would rationalize justice through various types of instrumentalization of it. And even when you look at the relationship between justice and lutf, one, it's like a chicken and egg situation, really. You know, you can't separate the two. And even it comes back to in Al-Bab al-Hadi Asha, even though lutf is not described a lot or analyzed a lot in the text, it's quite clear it's a central idea of the whole text. It's what actually keeps the whole text and every single doctrinal argument together. But there is an element of circularity involved in it. And ultimately, I think at its most basic, the idea is it's almost an apophatic argument for what justice is. And that is basically justice is not arbitrariness. It actually really comes down to that justice is not arbitrary and justice is not compulsion. Those are the two fundamental things that most of the theologians argued about. So when they were, for example, refuting the Ash'ira, or whether they were refuting a Sunni traditionalist, it always came down to this thing that basically you chaps believe in a God who is arbitrary, who does things which make no sense, which have no meaning, which are not placed within a rational context. And God cannot possibly work like that, because if God is working like that, then how are we expected to live rational lives? For example, if we concede that God may lie, you've got a huge problem. Now, the Mu'tazili argument was that God cannot possibly lie because it would be unjust. It would be a way in which He would be deceiving us through communication. Deception is not justice. The other response is, well, maybe he does mislead because God can do what He wants. So fundamentally, you know, at the heart, there were three or four negative arguments for why justice was absolutely central. And you even find that even within the medieval Sunni tradition, what then happens is a number of individuals actually come around to a position which is not entirely dissimilar, but they call it wisdom, divine wisdom. And you find that particularly, even with someone like Ibn Taymiyyah, his concept of divine wisdom is very much the justice of the Mu'tazila. Because if you don't hold to that, then you have a real problem of arbitrary nature of the way in which God acts, which basically means that it really doesn't matter what you do in the life. It's of no consequence. And that's a really problematic position for anyone who is a believer to hold.
Thank you very much for your well-planned talk and the way you've divided it. What I was wondering is, when imams reach their degree of understanding God, it's not in explaining it to us through the sifa or through the lut or through the action. In their own personal life, do the imams have their own way of reaching that understanding of God?
Do the imams have their own way of reaching God?
Yeah, I mean, of understanding.
I can't possibly answer that question because I don't know.
Are we given any indications in the books?
There are lots of indications that different people have different ways of knowing what that means. And if one assumes that some people have more perfect understandings of what God is, or at least even have an understanding of what God is, as opposed to those who don't, then that the quality of that's going to be different. All that we have basically are actions and sayings, and we can make sense of those actions and sayings and use that in sort of your own path to understanding or arriving at God. But what the internal states of the imam is or of the prophet, that's quite difficult to even get into.
Is there any differences in the degrees?
That's something which is even given in the Quran, that there's degrees of people who know.
Yeah, among the prophets.
Yeah, and their degrees in the prophets and their degrees in the awsiya as well, in the awliya.
Even in the 14 masumins, the imams as well,
I would say yes. At least at one level, there is a basic superiority of Imam Ali over the other imams. I mean, that's quite basic. I think that's very straightforward doctrine. And there's good reasons for saying that. As well. But the issue of whether there are sort of darajat in the imams are not discussed as much as whether there are, for example, amongst prophets, and then how they relate to imams. But the issue, I mean, you're absolutely right, the issue of knowledge is absolutely central. It comes back to the syllogism I was mentioning before, the fundamental issue of the choice of the imam and why the imam has to be of a certain perfection relates to the perfection in his knowledge. That's the ultimate excellence which is looked at.
We'll take one more question.
It's an interesting question. I mean, of course, there's the famous historical myth about Wasl ibn Atta. There are many individuals, and even the etymology of this term Mu'tazila, of withdrawing from a group or withdrawing from a discussion. But you're talking about something towards the end of the second century Hijri, but the writings don't emerge until slightly later than that. Well, I said this chap, Wasil ibn Atta, who is described as being the first person who i'tazala. There's a debate about whether that's really true, or that's just a foundational myth. And if you look at, for example, a work like the Tabaqat al-Mu'tazila, that describes like the history, the first generation, the next generation, and so forth. But the Mu'tazila, on the whole, were never a cohesive body. There were lots of different positions. And primarily in the early period, people talk about the difference between the Basrans and the Baghdadis. But there was actually a lot more than that. Broadly speaking, they only agreed on five principles. But even what those five principles meant, they had huge disagreements on them. And certainly a number of disagreements beyond that.
Assalamu alaikum. You mentioned about taqlid and possibly being haram.
Not possibly, absolutely being haram in matters of faith.
Right. Can you expand on that? I mean, do you mean it, you know, in the way that we do taqlid of the ayatullahs, that's haram?
No.
Or is it in a different context?
That's fiqh. Fiqh is a different, as I said, fiqh is a different area, jurisdiction, so to speak. So as I said, that's a different argument, which I don't want to get into. But certainly in matters of theology, in matters of belief about the nature of God, belief about guidance, belief about your moral responsibilities, and the fact that you have your own responsibility for yourself and where you're coming from and where you're going, there's absolutely no doubt that that's for you to work out. And all the texts from a very early period are very clear on that. And they explicitly talk about the impermissibility of doing taqlid in matters of faith, in aqaid. There's, in fact, a very famous late 12th century text by Sadid al-Din al-Himmasi al-Razi called Al-Munqidh min al-Taqlid. And it's quite funny, a few years ago, it's a very difficult text to find. You find it in the odd library here and there, but it's not available. And I remember a few years ago going into a bookseller's in Qom and saying, do you have Al-Munqidh min al-Taqlid? And I was getting some really dirty looks from some Iraqi mullahs because they obviously thought I was talking about something else. And I said, no, it's a kalam work. And they're like, okay, that's all right then. But there's a lot of confusion. These are the issue of what is theology and what is fiqh. They're quite distinct. I mean, they're related, but they're still quite distinct. And they really shouldn't be confused.
Thank you very much. I think we're on the salawat. Awesome.